Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening and welcome to CureTalks. This is Shweta Mishra, your host, and today we are going to discuss about new developments in management of polycystic ovary syndrome, a disorder which affects 1 in 5 girls and women with disturbing symptoms like excessive hair growth, acne, male pattern baldness, mood swings, and infertility. Our eminent expert for today's talk is Dr. Carolyn Alexander of Southern California Reproductive Center, who has done extensive research on PCOS and specializes with dealing with patients facing infertility as a result of PCOS. Welcome to the show, Dr. Alexander. It's our pleasure to have you with us today. On the patient panel, we have Ashley Levinson and Michelle Schwartz. Ashley has been very actively advocating for PCOS for the last 20 years and sits on the Patient Advisory Board for PCOS Challenge, the largest nonprofit support and advocacy organization globally for people with PCOS. Michelle on the panel is a PCOS patient as well as PCOS researcher. She is an epidemiologist in the pharmaceutical industry and currently on the Patient Advisory Board and co-chair of the Research Committee for PCOS Challenge. I welcome you both to Cure Talks, Ashley and Michelle. I also welcome our audience to the talk and want to inform that we will be discussing questions sent in via email at the last 10 minutes of the show. So you can email your questions to Shweta at trialx.com. Or you can post your questions on the website, curetalks.com, as you listen to the talk. We'll try our best to answer them as time permits. So, Dr. Alexander, welcome to the Cure Talks once again. And I want to begin this discussion by asking a question which is very basic, but also about which most of the mothers of teenage girls are confused about as their daughters start to menstruate at the age of 11 to 13. And that is, how early should a girl be screened for polycystic ovary syndrome? And at what age? Does early diagnosis mean that severity of the disease, say, for example, PCOS leading to excessive hair growth or acne or infertility, can be controlled? What do recent studies tell us?
So it's really important to recognize early signs of polycystic ovary syndrome, including early breast development, especially around age 8 or younger. That's extremely early. And early underarm hair can also be a signal. It can be familial, so in some families, women get earlier hair growth, but it's important to alert the pediatrician as well. And typically, we wait for 2 years from the first period before we label a young girl as irregular periods, because it takes anyone whose hypothalamic pituitary ovarian axis starts when they get their first period, it does take about 2 years before the traditional flow each month can occur. And so we tend to give it a little bit of time, hoping it will regulate. But in terms of chin hair or thickened sideburns or upper abdominal hair and lower back hair, if it's black and dark hair, it can be important to at least get some evaluation and talk it over with the pediatrician as well.
Sure. Thank you for that answer, Doctor. So I know with all of us with PCOS, as we reach our teenage and then adolescence and then adulthood, we have a variety of symptoms. And I want to give you a background on this PCOS tracker app, which is now being used by more than 6,000 anonymous women and helping them track their daily and monthly PCOS symptoms and seeing their monthly menstrual pain, their intensity of flow, hair growth intensity, acne problems, and mood swings. All these symptoms they're tracking. And we did a bit of an analysis on the data that was shared via this PCOS tracker. And one of the things we found was that irregular periods or irregular menstrual cycles is the main symptoms that makes women think they may have PCOS. And 60% of the women chose irregular periods as their predominant symptom. So my question to you is on the association of irregular periods and infertility issues. First of all, what causes irregular periods in PCOS? And then have you found in your research or have research studies shown that women who have irregular menstrual cycles as a predominant symptom tend to have more infertility problems than women who don't, who have, you know, regular menstrual cycles and still diagnosed with PCOS? Because I know we have women in our circle who have regular cycles with other PCOS symptoms, still having a hard time getting pregnant.
I think it's a great question. I think all that information from those women is so important and vital, and I think it's fantastic that you guys are collecting that. It's very interesting that a most common reason that patients come in is that their period's not coming every month, and it's really frustrating because all their friends are in college, their roommate is getting their period every month, and they're just waiting for their period, and sometimes it takes a few months. There's kind of two schools of thought of why polycystic ovary syndrome occurs. Some people think that LH pulsatility is more frequent, so there's an LH, chronic LH elevation, and so there isn't the traditional cycle where women ovulate one egg and have a peak LH surge at the mid-cycle and allow the egg to pop out so that they can make progesterone in the latter part of the cycle so that they can get an actual period when the corpus luteum dissolves and causes progesterone withdrawal, and then that causes a period to come out. Other people think that there's this chronic insulin elevation that leads to the ovaries having theca cell hyperplasia, which are the cells in the ovary that make testosterone. So T for theca makes testosterone, and then that makes a microenvironment around the ovary that causes the follicles to be in a halted state. And so instead of allowing the follicle to develop in a proper manner, they may or may not ovulate, and perhaps it even can be an immature egg, like a smaller follicle with a egg that perhaps can't get fertilized, which kind of rolls into why irregular periods may also impact why women try for many months and are trying to time their ovulation but can't quite figure out when their LH surge is going to happen. And so the premise of it is that irregular periods can mean irregular ovulation. And so the ovulation may not be at a traditional time point so that unprotected intercourse can cause fertilization at the timing that traditionally we see.
All right. So we do have studies showing that more irregular cycles means more infertility issues, right? Compared to the women who have regular cycles, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Thanks. That's helpful. With that, I guess I'll bring on the panel in this discussion. We have Ashley Levinson with us. Ashley, you're on air. Can you briefly introduce yourself and then go on to ask your questions? Please.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me this evening. My name is Ashley Levinson. Most people know me on social media as PCOS Girl. I have been a PCOS patient advocate for over 20 years. And in those 20 years, there have been a lot of advances, a lot of changes in how we perceive what PCOS is, what causes PCOS. But many people who have the condition, when they go to see their doctor, don't understand exactly what it is. Because you see people that have lean PCOS, you see obese women that have PCOS, and there even is an expanded definition to now include female-to-male transgender. So my question is, how do you define PCOS to your patients? What are some of the signs you look for in making a diagnosis with all this diversity?
So I take a detailed history, especially including family history. There seems to be an interesting finding that it's not only from like our mom's side that genes can pop up that cause polycystic ovary syndrome. There seems to be also a family history of the father's side having diabetes or early balding, and then there can be also if he has dyslipidemia or cholesterol problems, there can be some of those genes that manifest in her. And I think it's important to really tease out when the symptoms started in terms of the hair growth and making sure to evaluate the ovaries for any uncommon things that look like polycystic ovary syndrome, but could be different, like high prolactin or thyroid issues or something called non-classical adrenal hyperplasia, and as well as Cushing's syndrome, which can cause obesity as well as like a high blood pressure. And some of those young girls are misdiagnosed as polycystic ovary syndrome, but they actually may have something else that can be a little bit different to deal with as well. And so I think the detailed history, looking at the family history, I tend to tell patients it's not anything you specifically did, because I noticed, especially when patients come in with their parents or a sibling or someone, they'll say like, yeah, they're eating different or they're doing something different than everybody else in the family. And it's not necessarily anything the person's really doing that causes per se over a summer to gain weight or their periods to become irregular. It's very polygenetic. So it's multiple different genes that click on in place. There's some evidence about during fetal programming when she was in her mom's tummy that maybe there's epigenetic changes that happened during that time that may manifest when puberty starts. And it's, again, nothing this person specifically did. So I tend to say it's a polygenetic issue, but that there's a couple ways we tackle it so that as best as we can control the symptoms and protect from long-term consequences that can happen.
Awesome.
Well, then my next question is, once we know that we have PCOS, what types of options are available to treat PCOS? I know that ASRM had recently a conference, and there were some updates on new developments about management of the condition. Can you talk a little bit about what options are available or what new management techniques might be available?
Sure. I think traditionally most people talk about a birth control pill, but others, I see a lot of women, especially in Los Angeles here, that want to be natural and try non-birth control options, and we can use cyclic progesterone, and it can be a non-synthetic progesterone that we can use that they take for 12 days of the month, and that does bring on their period and keep the periods regular, but it is not contraception. So if it's a young woman who's not ready to start a family, that won't protect her from ovulating and getting pregnant. So there's kind of we kind of discuss specifically what their hopes are. Do they need contraception? Are they really focused on that, on the male pattern hair growth? It's really frustrating to see that for them. Do we need to block the testosterone so that they can stop having as much mood swings? Because sometimes when the testosterone seems to be quite high, I've noticed that they have some mood swings, and I say you have to, we use, you know, kind of non-traditional things in our armamentarium, including acupuncture, meditation, yoga, to help those things. But it's important to also look at the hormones and try to balance that. I think at the ASRM, there was really an interesting discussion in terms of in the future, but not quite now, of an LH blocker that is a medication that's an oral medication that was initially used for hot flashes, but that they were mentioning that maybe it'll actually block this chronic LH elevation in some young women and help regulate the menstrual cycle. And so they don't have a name for it, but it was a neurokinin B receptor antagonist. And it was an interesting discussion. It's the party line is 5% body weight loss if the women have a BMI over 30. That is probably the best thing we can do to help our patients with PCOS in terms of strategy.
Wonderful. With PCOS, often a lot of patients are focused on infertility or weight loss and immediate results. And often once those results are met or they're into a pattern, they don't consider that there may be some future risks with that. So my question is, what are some of the risk factors associated with PCOS?
Traditionally, I think of it as a young woman, it's the two P's, periods and pregnancy. So if the periods are not regular, there's a concern that the buildup of the endometrial or uterine lining can thicken and can actually have unopposed estrogen, which is like a yin-yang. And if there's too much estrogen, there can get precancer cells, which doesn't happen quickly, but in some younger patients over the last 15 years, I have seen that younger women can get a precancer, especially if their periods are really irregular. And so it's really important with one of the P's is to try to keep your periods regular or at least have a discussion with your doctor on how to tackle that. And then the other P is pregnancy. And so if they are having irregular periods, we can discuss ovulation and timing. We can be as natural as possible with just ultrasounds to see when the body is making the big follicle and helping them, guiding them to timing intercourse. Or it can be medications such as letrozole or Clomid, which have been around for some time, and they work as an anti-estrogen to tell the brain, oh my gosh, there's no estrogen. So then the pituitary gland sends FSH, follicle stimulating hormone, to the ovary to excite the ovary and make a follicle or an egg, which is in the follicle, pop up and become ready for fertilization with the sperm. And so there's kind of a few ways. But the long-term consequences, which we don't use fear factor to scare anyone, we just talk about it, is we check cholesterol fasting every other year. We check for diabetes every year. We check for, in terms of if they snore, then I send them to discuss sleep apnea. Some younger women snore, and it can be a risk for pulmonary hypertension and sleep apnea, which can be risky when we get older. And as well as mood issues, if they need to talk out their, if they're having some mood disorders, and we can talk that out and see if they, we use a multidisciplinary approach. And then the last one is something called non-alcoholic steatorrhea. So it can be early fatty liver of the liver, and that is important to talk to their primary care doctor about.
Great. So with all these different issues that can occur, how often should someone with PCOS see their provider?
Every year for liver kidney anemia check, as well as a check for diabetes. And then usually every other year we look at the lipids to keep an eye on the cholesterol and things like that. But I think it's important. And if their periods are irregular, they need to see their doctor sooner.
Right. And why do you think so many with PCOS are still undiagnosed or misdiagnosed?
I think that's a great question, because I was thinking about that. And I see a lot of women coming in saying, I'm like so frustrated. No one's listening to me. I feel like I've just been on my own battling my issues and stuff like that. I think it's kind of complex in a sense, is that a lot of the time if someone's BMI is high, we tend to just hope, or some physicians say, well, try to lose some weight and let's reevaluate, right? And then over time, how many times can you get told that without getting a full hormone panel, especially if there can be a correlation with PCOS with high prolactin, which can also lead to irregular periods, and maybe if that's remedied, that might make their periods better. And there can be other kind of hormone imbalances. I think it's also the thought that the woman's so young, like nothing's really wrong with her. So there's a little bit of confusion, but I think it's important to really be careful with irregular periods because of the risk for those precancer cells that can pop up in the lining.
Wonderful. I thank you so much for taking the time to answer these questions. I really appreciate it. I know that.
Thank you. I love your tweets and your Instagram.
One of my partners in crime, someone that I absolutely adore, that's been part of the PCOS community as long as I have, and who has done some tremendous work and tremendous activism, Michelle Schwartz is here, and I know she has a couple of questions that she wanted to ask as well. Michelle, if you could introduce yourself.
Yes, thank you, Ashley, for that very kind introduction, and thank you, Shweta, for having me on your show. I'm, as Ashley said, a PCOS researcher. I'm currently an epidemiologist. In my research, I have studied the knowledge of mental health providers around PCOS, specifically in psychologists and psychiatrists, and what we needed to do to increase their knowledge and have them screen and refer their patients for PCOS treatment. So given that, I was wondering from if Dr. Alexander could maybe tell us a little bit about your previous PCOS research and what you learned and maybe what new questions your research sparked.
Yeah, I think when I was at Cedars-Sinai, I worked closely with Dr. Ricardo Aziz and Mark Gadarzi on some looking carefully at genetics of PCOS, and we were initially hoping to find a link between the different types of PCOS and kind of a unified genetic complement of things that could lead to it. We looked carefully at the FSH receptor. We looked at the LH receptor. We looked at different genes that bind to the androgen or kind of male hormone receptors. And really what was kind of interesting is because we see such different ethnic backgrounds and different phenotypes, it wasn't anything specific of one gene that we could kind of say, yeah, this is the culprit, and maybe we could create medications or something that could sort of battle that issue. So I think the thing that popped up in my mind, which was helpful, is that how important it was to get a detailed family history from the father's side, because I think we always ask, how did your mom's periods go? How's your aunt's? And sort of that sort of thing. But from the dad's side, there's a lot of interesting remarks that they had a strong family history of diabetes or obesity or something like that. And then the questions it sparked is really what was interesting is the fetal programming or the actual reasons in the developing fetus of that person that led to maybe those epigenetic changes, which are different than an actual genetic mutation, that maybe we could help counsel the next generation of people so that when they're pregnant, maybe they could avoid those issues. I think it does seem that 3 months before we ovulate, our healthy eating matters and taking vitamins. And there's a lot of new interesting information about probiotics helping, especially the obese PCOS patient. But that's my answer.
Wow, that's really fascinating. And the new questions really deserve some attention. And that, I guess, begs the next question as to why are there so many gaps in PCOS research that are keeping us from finding out more?
Yeah, I think it was kind of complex to have the strict criteria to allow the patients into the study because I think, you know, really lumping together lean and obese PCOS and women who have really cystic acne on their back versus women who have all the, you know, the male hair on their chin or their upper belly, it's kind of harder to lump everybody together because probably they're a little bit different. And so I think that was part of why the research projects to really hone down things, why they're not all similar variables in the groups. But that's, and also, you know, there's getting women to get involved with research is, we did it. We worked really hard at the time to do lots of research with them, but it was harder, you know.
Understandably. I think we as PCOS researchers have had a lot of difficulty getting funding for research, and I think it's certainly one of the biggest reasons why we have the gaps in the research. I looked into the current state of research endeavors, and right now there are less than 40 active studies on PCOS in the United States, and almost none of them are NIH funded. So in your opinion, what do you think we can do to increase PCOS funding and research?
I think it all starts with the NIH and awareness and what they, I think they set specific goals. Like sometimes it's maternal health so that there's less mortality in pregnancy for, that's a big, you know, topic right now. And especially there's a lot of research in men and like prostate and those kinds of things. So I think it's at the level of sort of our government officials and things like that, that maybe if they had more awareness that it's such a big, it really is one in eight or even more frequently than that, that we do see this issue. So I think what you're doing is like amazing and really important to bring about awareness of the issue.
Great, thanks. While looking at clinicaltrials.gov, I noticed that there were currently a handful of studies underway in PCOS for medications that are FDA approved for other conditions. So for example, Orilissa, which is an endometriosis drug, and Byetta, which is a diabetes drug. And the oral contraceptive pills, metformin, letrozole, spironolactone are among the more common, although unapproved, medical treatments for PCOS. Do you ever go out of the box and prescribe those newer medications to women with PCOS? I'm just interested if you have, which ones you've tried and what the results have been, and if you maybe look for certain factors in certain women, so like age or PCOS phenotype, or other considerations when you think about using these other treatment options.
Yeah, I think there's a couple important, like the last 10 years has changed a bit. So in the past, we really were limiting metformin to women with a hemoglobin A1C or a blood test that showed that their average of glucose over the last 3 months was showing that it was high, or if they had signs of acanthosis nigricans, which is kind of a darkening of the skin between the thighs or at the neck. We were really super proactive to make sure to talk about the medication and encourage women to take it. There's newer studies showing that lean PCOS patients that may not have those issues actually may benefit as well for risk of gestational diabetes or diabetes in pregnancy and things like that. The one medication that I've used outside the box, and I keep a list of the women I have on it, is called finasteride or Proscar, and it works really well in women who cannot tolerate spironolactone for acne or the male pattern hair growth, and they're really frustrated because nothing's making their testosterone stop making those hairs grow or the cystic acne. And a very low dose of finasteride has been shown to help with those situations. I think there's some studies looking at it for the long run also for lipids or cholesterol, because if you can block the androgens or the male hormones, then maybe we'll have a better cholesterol profile and things like that. But we're very careful to use that in women who are not trying to get pregnant right now. My colleague does use Byetta. She's a medical endocrinologist that I work closely with, but I tend to be a little more cautious if they're pre-pregnancy, like in a year or two they may try to get pregnant, because it's the long-term safety data is not really there for that. And so I think it's a little bit, we have to walk cautiously on things like that, because I don't know the ramifications unless she's post having her family, then maybe, because Byetta has been shown to improve the weight, and that can be improving the other metabolic issues too.
Great, thanks. And so in my line of research, especially among psychiatrists, what my findings were is that they prefer to treat the conditions that are presented to them. So if they have a woman with PCOS, they'll treat the depression or anxiety or bipolar disorder, and they tend not to give consideration to the effect of that, the treatment to the PCOS. So I was wondering what advice you can give other practitioners, especially in other specialties, about working with women with PCOS and what you would want them to know about PCOS.
I think I just want to re-echo that, you know, if the periods are really irregular, that it's important at least to get evaluation for that and not let it go, because that's like one of the things that we really have to be cautious about, as well as checking for diabetes each year, because that can pop up in thin or overweight women very kind of relatively quickly in some situations. But I think one thing, because I really get intimate and talk to patients so closely and so, for such a long time, and I have patients who've been around for like under my care for a long time, is that I've noticed that there is these moments of rage, and I don't know, and when they're untreated and not on medications and things. And I think it can be in women who are very mild-mannered, and it's just these moments. And I feel like from my side of it, I'm trying to tackle it from the hormone side, but I think there's probably other ways that the cognitive behavior therapy or the psychiatrist can use other tools to help with that sense of being a little bit out of control of the mood, because it's a repetitive thing I hear, but I don't know if it's anything, you know, specific, but that's what I hear from clinical, like seeing the patients. Yeah.
Great. Thank
right.
you so much.
Thanks. Thanks a lot, Michelle, for your wonderful questions. And it was really wonderful listening to your discussion with Dr. Alexander. Before I move on to the audience questions now, I have one question for all three of you. How do you think citizen science can help in accelerating the process to find a cure to PCOS that is upsetting the lives of 1 in 5 women? Do you think if we keep track of our symptoms on daily and monthly basis with the help of mHealth apps like the PCOS tracker, will it help inform the doctors and the researchers better and help accelerate cure? Dr. Alexander, you can start, and then Michelle and Ashley can follow.
Yeah, I think knowledge is power, and so having that real life, you know, real patients' information is very valuable, especially if there's a pattern or something with puberty, so that pediatricians can recognize earlier signs and perhaps intervene. Because when the hair, especially on the face or in different parts of the body, terminalizes or becomes that darker, thicker hair, it's hard to turn back the time to when it was a mm-hmm. little bit less. And that is, it's a, such a vital time in that time window, and as well as, you know, diet modifications, increasing exercise and those kinds of things to counsel people. So I think that information is so valuable and helpful. In terms of like infertility as well, to guide women to seek help sooner than to just wait and be frustrated and then time goes by and it starts to become a bigger issue, perhaps at least popping up the discussion of talk about it with a physician. Or so those are my thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Michelle, you want to comment on it?
Sure, absolutely. I think citizen science is where we need to go right now when we're dealing with a condition that is so overlooked by funding. And it's a wonderful resource for hypothesis generation. In fact, the industry is now really relying on real-world evidence in post-marketing studies for drugs. I don't know why we can't start there to generate ideas as to what's causing PCOS. We have some great ideas, but we're not sure. We also can start seeing and maybe better putting into categories the types mm-hmm. of PCOS that are out there. And
absolutely,
more mm-hmm. information is better, and especially in the age of big data, and where you have advocates like Ashley and myself, and we're now becoming the first line of mm-hmm. advocacy and push for additional research. This is a great way to start, and maybe we're onto something new. This hasn't been done before, and maybe PCOS could be the condition that starts this new trend of citizen science, where we're mm-hmm. saying what we want done and how we want done and push for that cure. I think having this certainly will make us not ignorable.
Sure.
Well, yeah, that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Dr. Alexander, you have
no, that was it. I thought that was great.
Sure. Okay, Ashley, do you have any comments on this question?
Just briefly echoing what Michelle said, citizen science really is an extension of activism. It gives everyone in our community a chance to participate, to show evidence, and to drive the research and the funding towards the research. So I think it's vitally important. You know, a lot of people always ask, what can I do? How can I get people to understand? By participating in these research studies and citizen science, that's a way that everyone can raise their voice and let researchers and providers know that that we need to be heard and that this is a condition that cannot be ignored anymore.
That's right. Okay, absolutely. Thank you so much for your answers, everyone. Without further delay, I think I'll just move on to the audience questions. We have quite a few number of questions coming in. So I'll just go ahead first with a question is asked. A person is asking, does acupuncture work as a treatment for PCOS? So there are a couple of them. Does losing weight cure PCOS or eliminate the symptoms? And how can lab work return as normal, yet PCOS symptoms persist or exist?
Yeah, so sometimes at the, especially with the male pattern hair, it can be the specific sensitivity to testosterone or dihydrotestosterone to actually make those hairs grow. So it may not be, and it may be ethnic specific. So some ethnicities, we were using a little bit of a lower testosterone to say that's abnormal versus others, because we're putting everybody in one category, but maybe in some specific people, the normal blood tests may not be normal for them specifically. But in terms of, I am a big believer in acupuncture. I found it to be very valuable when I was trying to get pregnant. I think also it does definitely lower cortisol, which can be high, which is our stress hormone. And so I think there's something to actually, you know, laying in all the important Eastern medicine techniques they use. So I do find it valuable. I think definitely there's a lot of evidence about the 5% body weight loss in women with a higher BMI, that's been shown to improve ovulation as well as regular menstrual cycles and improving metabolic function in the system.
Sure. Okay. I think there's a third question which also asked, how can lab works return normal yet PCOS symptoms exist? So what's your answer to that?
It may be a specific type of receptor in that person that the blood tests look normal, but for them the endogenous testosterone is still causing issues.
Can I comment on that also? Because real fast, a lot of providers that I've talked to about this situation say that sometimes the ranges are set a little too low or a little too high, and that with PCOS you have to look at things as a bigger picture rather than just looking at things that fall within the ranges, because there are a lot of nuances. And also with like TSH, sometimes they might do a basic TSH instead of looking for free testosterone or things that, again, require a little more nuance. I mean, Dr. Alexander, what do you feel about that as far as the ranges are concerned?
I think that's really well said. Yeah, I totally agree with that. That's why we look at the whole detailed history and talk it over versus just kind of quickly saying that looks fine and nothing's wrong. And so we look at everything in peace.
Sure. All right. So the next upcoming question is, the person says, I was diagnosed 12 years ago. I have been on metformin for 12 years. Nothing seems to work except expensive shots to get me ovulate properly. And I recently lost 100 pounds with a keto diet. I still have been unable to conceive. Are there any new inexpensive treatments to help conceive?
Yeah, that one's a little bit harder to I would encourage diet and exercise, because I think that also, but sounds like that's an amazing job you're doing with that. Traditionally, the medications, are a little bit more costly. At some pharmacies, you can save a bit of cost for, especially if oral tablets are not working to help you ovulate versus the medications that are injectable medications. But nothing specific other than potentially in a few years, if this newer oral medication is available, that maybe it'll help lower the LH, which lowers the likelihood of properly ovulating. So maybe there's things on the horizon, but not right now.
Now, also, I mean, I know that I've seen that a lot of doctors will turn to using Clomid and Metformin. What is your feeling about the letrozole? Because I know there have been studies in which it shows the letrozole has been more effective for people with PCOS who are facing infertility.
Mm-hmm. Letrozole is not an anti-estrogen at the uterine lining, and so Clomid has a tendency to be an anti-estrogen at the uterine lining and causes a thinning of the lining. And so that can also lead to a difficulty for the embryo to stick inside the uterus for some people taking Clomid over and over and saying, why isn't the Clomid working? I'm for sure ovulating. And the nice thing about letrozole is that it actually is an anti-estrogen at the pituitary, so it helps work in a similar way, but it also is not an anti-estrogen at the uterine lining, so people tend to get pregnant a little more easily, as well as we're seeing less twins with letrozole versus Clomid when we used to cause, more twins, which has a higher risk for the pregnancy. And so we're really finding that letrozole has been being shown, in, especially in women with PCOS, to be beneficial and more successful in general and less side effects. So
thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for that answer, doctor. The next question is on diet. So the person says she writes a little bit about the keto diet that she's been following, and she says a low-carb diet, under 100 carbs a day, or even ketogenic diet with a return to saturated fats and animal proteins with no grains, no sugar, and starchy vegetables. Low sugar fruits eaten on occasion would perhaps prevent or reverse PCOS rather than manage or treat it with drugs for life. Would you agree to that, Dr. Og?
I think it's a little bit hard because, again, it depends on the other issues the person may have, like their BMI and cholesterol and things like that, to look at the whole picture, as well as their hemoglobin A1C, which is the sign of prediabetes or real diabetes. So I think it, and I tend to be a moderate kind of person in terms of extreme diets, because I get worried that it's so hard to maintain such a low carb thing, and then suddenly when they're pregnant, we're letting them just eat regularly, and it starts to become like a big yo-yo in the system. I think if a person is at a higher BMI and really needs to strategize to work hard on it, I think that's reasonable. But then I think if they're more of in the middle of the road, it's harder for me to encourage such limitation, especially in the younger women. It's like early college students. I think that's not fair to say everybody else is sort of eating, so I tend to say nutrition's over 7 days, and it over the 7 days, try to be super vigilant with 5 or 6 of the days, and one of the days you can have kind of a normal weekend day to be just normal, whatever, within reason of calories and stuff like that. But so I don't know if that exactly answers the question, so but that's the way I approach it.
Right, absolutely. Thank you so much for that input, doctor. The next question is actually a concern. She says, my main concern is not being able to conceive or having any trouble in the future to conceive a baby. I have had several cyst ruptures, and the biggest one I have had was about the size of a mandarin fruit. So what do you have to say for her?
Unruptured follicles is very frustrating. So that tends to be a follicle, which holds the microscopic egg inside of it, and it just mm-hmm. never gets the proper signal from the pituitary gland in the brain to actually ovulate, and so it can become a very large cyst. I had a very big cyst as well. I mean, it just sometimes when people are very stressed out, their body won't ovulate, and then this follicle becomes this kind of bigger problem for us. So I think it's very important to monitor your menstrual cycles with a menstrual calendar. Mm-hmm. And if mm-hmm. If the person's sensing that their periods are going past 35 days apart, they really need mm-hmm. to get evaluated, so that means the egg never really came out. And so that can lead to unruptured cysts, which can then rupture later, which can be quite painful. In some circumstances, though, I know it's not always the best answer to say, in some circumstances, we see a benefit in taking a low-dose birth control pill, because in those patients, we tend to avoid making cysts. And so if they're not ready to try to start a family, it's useful because it's contraception as well as lowering testosterone, as well as kind of regulating the menstrual cycles, and there tends to be less cysts. But in terms of trying to conceive, you'd work closely with either your OBGYN or a fertility specialist to really tailor the care to make sure to avoid cysts.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sure. Thanks. Thanks for that answer, doctor. The next question is, again, I think about lifestyle and diet, and the person says that, is there such a thing as unmanageable PCOS? You see, I have a pituitary tumor, and I'm starting to suspect my symptoms could be due to that instead of PCOS. If it is not possible at the moment to have a cure for PCOS, I wish there was at least a definite test available for it. That would save us a lot of confusion. She says that she has been following healthiest lifestyle and diet with best metabolic profile possible, insulin resistance, no cholesterol, no inflammation. Yet, despite all this, symptoms stay. So that's her concern.
So I think that's a really good question. I also really feel I wish there was kind of the Europeans are leaning towards using one blood test called AMH, anti-mullerian hormone, and they've had papers saying anyone with an AMH over 8 usually has PCOS. I think it's a little confusing here, because sometimes we'll have people with a high AMH, but they may have non-classical adrenal hyperplasia, and we have to be very careful to not just mm-hmm. quickly say, yeah, based on one easy test, the person has polycystic ovary syndrome, when they may have something else going on. But in my mind, the way is really the 2 out of 3 criteria. So irregular menstrual cycles, the blood tests. So we do a full panel of androgens and check everything, as well as the ultrasound. And if a person has 2 out of 3, that tends to lean to us diagnosing PCOS, and we do check pituitary hormones in those blood tests to tease out the people who have prolactinomas or prolactin pituitary tumors versus other issues versus PCOS. But I completely agree. I wish there was like one quick test, but the only one mm-hmm. I can think of is AMH. And again, the Europeans are kind of using that as a tool too.
Right. Okay. So the next question is in line with what Michelle was talking about psychologists and psychiatrists. So the question is, the person says 4 out of 5 clinical psychologists are women, and this person is from UK. 1 in 5 women have PCOS, and this means at least 1 in 10 clinical psychologists have PCOS. So many women with PCOS experience psychological issues like anxiety and depression. So why are so few clinical psychologists interested in PCOS?
I think that's really a great question, because I was trying to think, you know, how often we work really closely with our psychologists in the area. Like, I'm always talking to them and on the phone and stuff to talk about different patients. But I think it's a little bit of denial, too, is like, you know, oh, people are just hormonal. We all, I get mm-hmm. PMS a little bit too. Like, we all get a little bit of hormonal things. And so sometimes it's just because society sort of says it's that time and people get hormonal. And so I think it's important to recognize the bigger picture and look at everything very carefully, especially for quality of life for that individual and helping them get the best they can be and stuff like that. But I don't know if that exactly answers it, but that's my thought on it.
I would love to chime in as well.
Sure.
I've actually collected data around this, and it's mm-hmm. important to make the distinction between a psychologist, which is someone with like a PhD, and mm-hmm. a psychiatrist, who is a medical doctor. I found that psychologists, it's not that they're not interested, it's that learning about medical conditions in their degree isn't necessarily part of the curriculum. It's something they have to like maybe get through continued education. And in my research, I found that clinical psychologists are incredibly receptive to learning about PCOS, but it's not necessarily knowledge they come into their practice with. So it's something that the patient will have to bring to the psychologist to get attention, unless they happen to be familiar with it. So if we do a better job educating them, they're definitely more receptive to knowing and treating their patients with PCOS. And anecdotally, after my study, I had a couple of psychologists reach out to me and thank me for letting them participate, because they were able to make the connection and pick up on some symptoms in their patients and help them go on to screen for and get treated for PCOS. Psychiatrists, on the other hand, they have a little bit of a cognitive dissonance, meaning that I asked them and they correctly said that about 1 in 10 women have PCOS. And then I asked them, well, how many women in your practice have PCOS? And they said less than 1%. So there's definitely a disconnection between their knowledge and mm-hmm. what they think they're seeing in their practice. So again, it relies on us to go in and maybe change the perception. So I think with psychologists, they're willing if we just open the door for them. And I think psychiatrists also need help from their from other specialists, from other physicians. But we need to do a better job of treating our patients as a whole and not just their parts. Not just their psychiatry at the moment.
And I just wanted to add one more thing to this. Mood disorders mm-hmm. in women with PCOS is quite often really kind of brushed under the rug, which I don't understand, because there are about 45% of women who present with anxiety that have PCOS. There are 34%
right.
in the studies that show women have depression, higher rates of suicide, sleep disorders, binge eating. It's something that should be focused on more. I know that there is a gentleman in the UK that is doing research on mood disorders associated with PCOS. And I think mm-hmm. it's really important that these providers are brought into this. Someone who is wonderful that I recommend to everyone, Gretchen Kubacki. She has PCOS. She is also a provider. And I think the key is for providers to kind of train other providers in these areas. So much has been put on patients. It's been our onus to kind of figure out what PCOS is, tell the doctors what the symptoms are, and I think it's time that the providers get interested enough in doing the research and meeting the patient halfway.
So, yeah, thanks for the answer to that question, Dr. Alexander, Michelle, and Ashley. The next question, I think this is the last question that we have right now before we wind up the talk. The person asks, can you suggest me how to cure my PCOS? And what are the most important few things that a person newly diagnosed with PCOS should start doing so that she can control the symptoms of her disease to a good extent?
I think that's a great question. Keep a menstrual diary, so keep track of your periods. I think it's very important to see a physician to get the panel of blood tests that we traditionally do to look into which vitamins may help, as well as which possible medications, if they're necessary, can benefit your overall health as well as the long-term health. We traditionally do an ultrasound to make sure the ovaries, you know, specifically don't have any cysts or any issues, as well as talk about exercise and increasing your heart rate past 135 for at least 20 minutes every other day to kind of, you know, really amp up your cardio so that the heart, which is a muscle, pumps and improves your circulation, which then can improve your overall health as well as the weight issue, if there is one. And then what I've seen is, you know, it depends on the different metabolic types of people. Some people really do well with no food 8:30 to 7:30 in the morning, so 8 p.m. sort of to 7 a.m., and that tends to help their body. And some people, it doesn't work for them from work. They get in traffic and they can't get home and, you know, those kinds of things. So we look at which type of a diet works. Mediterranean-style diet is more what I believe helps, especially pre-pregnancy, because it has colorful vegetables and, you know, lower carb fruits and lean meats, and I think that's helpful. But no, there's no one-size-fits-all. Like, for me versus my own sister, like, our body types are totally different, and so everybody has to figure out what works for them. But that would be my advice.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Alexander, for wonderful advice that you've given us in the last 1 hour. I think we'll have to wind up our talk now. It's already the end of the hour now. PCOS is disturbing the lives of 1 in 5 women, yet it remains a little understood disorder. It is still hard for doctors to treat it and help their patients manage the symptoms. We just heard Dr. Carolyn Alexander of Southern California Reproductive Center discuss what best can be done to deal with various symptoms of PCOS and share about the latest ongoing research that may become helpful for PCOS patients in managing their disease in the future. We hope to see a speedier advancement in PCOS research so we have better solutions for us and our daughters and the upcoming generation of PCOS sufferers. Dr. Alexander, thank you so very much for your time today and educating us on a disorder that is affecting millions daily. Ashley, Michelle, thanks for your participation and your insightful questions that really brought out a very informative discussion. Audience, I thank you for your overwhelming response and your questions. And I want to share with you all our PCOS tracker that is helping more than 6,000 women now to keep track of their daily and monthly PCOS symptoms. And it is available on iOS and Google Play stores. Please see if you'd like to track your symptoms with PCOS tracker, and any of your reviews and feedback will only help us help you better. And if you wish to participate in clinical trials related to PCOS, please visit on our page, curetalks.com, and click on Find PCOS Trial. And if you're in Philadelphia, the Penn PCOS Center at the University of Pennsylvania is conducting a 6-month research study to compare the effects of medications on metabolic risk factors for women with PCOS. And the study is called the COMET PCOS study. And if interested, you can take the pre-screening survey at tinyurl.com/COMET PCOS, or you can call them at 215-662-7727 to get more info. Please write to me at shweta@trialix.com about your feedback on Q-Talks and suggestions on topics that you would like to be covered on the show. The link for today's show will be sent via email to all the participants. So until next time, thank you and have a great day, everyone. Bye-bye.